دوزامو فرزند کارمو مازامو خارج دانیزمو کانیزه اوکه گرون بای مونا گوچو مغزم تو نسو دوزامو فرزند کارمو
नमस्कार आणि स्वागत करता हाँ तुमका आयच्या सुशेगा दनपार कोंकणी रेडिओ प्रोग्रामार. आम्ही वो प्रोग्राम 104.6 प्लॅनेट एफ एम आवयदन ब्रॉडकास्ट करता. आज मुझे सांगा था मुझो एक फ्रेंड आणि प्रोफेशनल कोलीग सेड्रिक डेमेलो हू इज विजिटिंग फ्रॉम न्यूझीलंड मुझे सांगा था आज असा स्टुडिओत. After spending over 5 years of voluntary work in Africa and 1 year of traveling, hopping across the globe, he's on his way back to Australia where he has settled down. Cedric, welcome to our Auckland Konkani radio program, Sushega Tanpar.
Thank you everybody for having me here and looking forward to chatting with you. And hello all Sushega Tanpar listeners. Good to meet you all.
Oh, that's nice, Cedric. How has been your journey so far in New Zealand? Are you visiting here for the first time or you visited New Zealand before?
No, actually, I have visited New Zealand about 5 times over the last 3 decades.
Okay.
So I had some friends long ago from India who were staying here. And I did most of my holidaying in that time. And I also went down to the South Island and did the Milford Sound trek and had your wonderful wines and the Sauvignon Blancs. And I'm a keen follower of New Zealand cricket. So,
oh, great, yeah. Great. Cedric, you are settled in Australia for more than 2 decades or 3 decades?
Almost 3, really. Yes.
Oh, okay. So where did you migrate from?
I grew up in India. I did my primary schooling in Goa, and then I went to Mount Abu, Rajasthan, and then did my university in Mumbai, Bombay, did my chartered accounting in Ferguson's, and then went for 5 years to the US, where I did a master's in finance and in the doctorate program for a couple of years before I dropped out and went to Australia.
Yeah. Any reason why you dropped out of your doctorate program?
Oh, I thought it was just too long, and I wanted to get into business and get on the ground, get some money as well.
Oh, okay. So anybody still there back in India? Do you go back to India?
Yes, in fact, I've gone for the last 10 years, every year in December.
Uh-huh.
And it's ranged from about 2 weeks to about 2 months, because my father and mother are there, and my aunts. And I did grow up in India, so there's nostalgia and sentiment with being there. So right now, it's really my family that draws me there, and just Mumbai, because I grew up there.
Okay.
My roots.
Okay. So what's the difference when you grew up? You lived for quite some time away from India. What's the difference now that you see, and what was it when you grew up?
Oh, when I was in India, I have to say, my dad was an engineer, so he went around quite a bit. And I stayed in varied places, which was very enjoyable. But then since he was moving around so much, they sent me to a boarding school, Mount Abu. And I had some of the best years of my life there, made some wonderful friends. And then, of course, when you finish, I got my first exposure to wildlife, because we were always in the jungles. And my mother used to come up and ask the principal, "Well, is this guy studying hard?" And the priest used to tell her, "Oh well, this guy's always in the woods. He's always in the jungles." And that was it. And then later, I went to Mumbai University and I really enjoyed Mumbai too, because I think it's a great city. But I must say, you know, India also was. And in those years, which was in 73 to 77, lacked opportunity, and it could be quite stifling for some people. And I had the urge to break away. So I went and did my university in the U.S. But now I find that India's new. It's so energized. And as you know, it's growing so rapidly. So all of a sudden, I'm very glad to have a foot in India again. I'm glad to have a foot in India and 1 foot in Australia. Best of both worlds.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So tell me, Cedric, you had a very successful career in the corporate world. You worked for Citibank for a very, very long period of time. So what were the highs and lows in this so-called sought-after banking industry?
Yeah, I was. I actually, when I first went there, I was in Pricewaterhouse Irwick for quite some time as a consultant. So that gave me exposure to various industries, and that formed the good building blocks for a corporate career. And then I went into ANZ Bank and Citibank, of course, and a couple of other financial institutions. And I must say, I did enjoy that work while I was there, because finance is mentally challenging. And And plus, you were at the forefront of economic issues and finance issues. So despite the long hours, I did enjoy the challenges of work and also managing people, which was I managed quite a large number of people, and it was good to develop those skills as well. So the corporate world did excite me for some time, but I have to say, with time, the routines and all also began to jade me in a bit. So one has contradictory feelings with time, and eventually one gets the feeling one has been there, one has done it, and maybe it's time to make the next step.
So you were in more of a routine type of a job, which is, or was it something which is exciting, sure shot, do it for some period, high decibel levels of noise, adrenaline flowing? So you do it and then you get away and then come back again, or was it more of a routine type of work that you do?
Oh, actually, in almost all my 30 years, I was a manager and at the senior manager level, and I was at the CFO level for some time as well. So initially, most of the time, it was really coordinating and achieving our objectives with other departments. I was involved in the policy and strategy area also quite a bit. So there was routine too. I mean, the inevitable routines are the month ends and the year ends and the tax routine. But there was a lot of ad hoc work too. And as you know, the finance industry is very dynamic, and it's got to respond to a changing environment. So there was no end to it, really.
So you stepped out of that environment. You sort of say, I've had enough of it. I've done enough of it now. And you went into voluntary work. Why? I mean, you had everything going for you.
Well, as you say, the years go on, and the routine after some time presents less of a challenge. And I did combine my work with traveling, and I did volunteer work for about 10 years, but on a temporary basis. I used to work for the Red Cross, which was visiting aged people in their homes. And it wasn't a big scale. It was about 1.5 hours every second week. But at the same time, I found it had its rewards. So I had tested the waters. And while I was traveling in Africa after around in my mid-50s, I was quite excited by the continent and by the wildlife there. And I knew Africa is a destination for volunteers. And so that idea, the nascent idea, slowly came to fruition in my mind. And I said, why not combine my life, my life of travel and wildlife and a volunteer initiative. And possibly, you start thinking, life is finite. Let's start giving back something to the world and combine it with your life. And so I did decide to, I did some research on wildlife there, and then Cheetah Conservation Botswana in Gaborone had a position there, and I just jumped at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But tell me, Cedric, you had a very nice career objective which you had planned as you grew up as such, and then halfway through your career, or rather some part of your life, you decided to go into voluntary work. What's the tipping point, apart from the routine as such? Is it your value systems have changed, or is it you have got a new set of goals? What is it that sort of made you shift gears and move into voluntary work, shift gears and give up this life?
What I thought is that, as you say, during the initial years of your life, you're more building your economic capacity, and you've got your financial commitments. But then, as I was going through my 50s, I had established my financial goals, and I was quite prudent in my earlier life. So I had the financial capacity to do it. And secondly is that I also wanted to break away from the corporate routine, which was encroaching more on my personal life, I thought, because the long hours and the never relenting pace, and you also at that time you think, well, your life is finite, and when you reach the end of your life, you want to go back and reflect on some memories, and this would be a really good one. like Africa, for many years.
It has been at the back of your mind to pursue your passion of voluntary work or to be in association with nature or to helping out others, is it?
Yes, that's right. Let's say there are my personal objectives too, but I want to combine it with that objective. I find it very rewarding. Yeah, at this stage, I find it very mentally very, very rewarding.
Okay, on that note, Cedric, let's take a break and let's listen to some music. You're listening to Sushekha Thanpar on 104.6 Planet FM.
Wasai tahai mirani, I love us tum tengawan, gazwala umra chapani, balay ek pari maje manan, tila bagun kai sangu tumana, sona lagle ti cherupan, are bawando no kupum karu, gapchup sangat ti chikanan. Wasai tahai mirani, I love us tum chengawan, gazwala umra chapani, balay ek pari maje manan. I love us tum chengawan, gazwala umra chapani, balay ek pari maje manan. Tichi gaga, tichi mati awar chalai kai ti nakrean. Dole tichi kai chamak kandai shi nakidrahan abalan. Mati chigaga, tichi mati awar chalai kai ti nakrean. Dole tichi kai chamak kandai shi nakidrahan abalan. Tichi maye tirangan, paslu tichi chalan. Bakun tichi chawani, hiwara bhalla maje angan. Dishele nauri joram cha kai sobe aiso watte aaj mana me bi nauraninge ani ti kai dishele nauri joram cha kai sobe doga ami joryashi teulan bandu gati ani maye shigazu amche dis narati
तुम्ही ऐकतात 104.6 प्लॅनेट एफ एम अवर सुशेगा दनपार. वो प्रोग्राम स्पॉन्सर केला मॉर्गेज मास्टर्सांत. A few moments ago, Cedric, we were talking about your decision to combine your corporate sort of lifestyle or corporate sort of work with your voluntary work and your passion for voluntary work as such. Ultimately, after 10 years of doing part-time voluntary work, you found something of your interest in Africa. So could you tell us a little bit more about the work that started off and how you stayed back in Africa as such?
Okay, so the first 2 years and 3 months, I was with wildlife, Cheetah Conservation Botswana. And then after that, I went for a little more than 2 years with a School for Life in Uganda. So initially, the work was with wildlife in Botswana. And the aim was to conserve the cheetah. And my work was really training people in finance and management and different corporate objectives for those 2 years. I went there as a coach, so I wasn't taking anyone's job. And I was volunteering, so my objective was to build up financial capital, to build up human capital in a sense, build up the capabilities of the staff and ensure that they were able to sustain those activities on a long-term basis. So that was my brief. Get there, train them. Get out. and initially it was 6 months, and slowly it lengthened. But I found, I must say, the first thing I realized was that many of the stereotypes of Africa were dispelled very quickly. You know, you hear so much about the ethnic strife and the genocides and the divisiveness that pervades a lot of Africa. And in a way that's true, but the day-to-day life is quite different. And I really quite embraced the Africans and the attempts to conserve wildlife. The funny thing is about the cheetahs is that you realize also that while there are many threats from the environment in terms of a genetic bottleneck and in terms of exposure to other predators like the lion, you also realize that it's man that's the apex predator. And it wasn't always the case, but what's happening is that a lot of things like climate change or just the expansion of agriculture by the native farmer is really encroaching on wildlife territory. And, you know, animals have the same requirements as us. They want water, they want resource, they want trees. So there's this conflict. And unfortunately, as they're... As their territories diminish and as their habit is degraded, they encroach on farmers' lands and they go for the more vulnerable animals, the domestic cattle. So you have wildlife going onto easier sort of environments and posing a real threat to the farmer's livelihood. So a man with a gun is the most lethal predator, and mm-hmm. that's what we have. Yeah.
So as a coach, you try to sort of enhance the human capital in that cheetah conservation program.
That's right.
Okay. So you would have taught them how to prepare your budgets and how to prepare resource plans or how to raise resources and so on and so forth.
That's right.
You mentioned about this whole endangerment to the animal life.
Yes.
How did you sort of integrate these sort of back office operations with the front office, you know, the front office challenges that are there? And how do you translate that into telling people, hey, this is what we are doing? And you have another set of people, no, you don't have to do this because we have to even grow economically.
Right. Yeah, that's
so how did this human capital sort of help you to sort of train them to preserve plus be more sustainable?
Yeah, the first thing is that you got to have a very visible financials and reporting to all your donors. Remember, all your donors are from overseas. So unless they have a reasonable degree of assurance that your funds, that their funds are being filtered right down to the ultimate beneficiary, the cheetah, they will be more reluctant to give you those funds. So you require good governance. And so that's one thing. in a way, you got to make sure that the funding of the donors is there, that it's secure, and that you're reporting them and giving them appropriate feedback. So that's an indirect way to contribute to it.
That's pretty nice, Cedric, of explaining as to how you link your coaching program or your coaching activities and building up capabilities on the human side of the conservative program. But can you describe an incident or a situation which sort of brings you more closer to understanding how actually the life of the cheetahs are threatened? And how do they respond to it? And what's have you ever witnessed something like that?
Yes, I was involved in relocating cheetah on one case in Botswana itself. And here, a farmer called up the organization and said, "Look, this cheetah is attacking my cattle, and I'm going to shoot it if you don't get it out." So there were direct upfront personnel at the front line who actually captured the cheetah. But then I came along later, and we had to inject that cheetah. We had to take it in a cage, and we had to drug it. And then we had to go and put it in a more congenial environment. And we have got to select that very carefully, because it can go from the frying pan to the fire. You could put it in an environment where there are lions around, and lions and cheetahs just hate each other. And the reality struck me in a very stark way when we went to the Serengeti once, and I went with another friend of mine there, and I saw the first live kill of a cheetah, and I was just aware of what habitat the cheetah really requires if it's got to survive. Remember, the cheetah's a carnivore. It can't eat vegetarian. It's got to have meat. So a kill is essential to a cheetah's existence. So there's a bit of bloodletting involved. But the thing was, we saw this cheetah coming in, and it was on the Serengeti Plains, and there was a mound. And on the right-hand side of this panorama, we could see a herd of impala. And impala generally congregate in herds of about 50, or 30 to 60, sorry. And we saw this cheetah go up a mound, a hill, which we know is the best vantage point for the cheetah to survey its prey. And so we see the impala there innocently grazing. We see the cheetah there, and the cheetah scanning the landscape. And we know the cheetah has to make a very good calculation. It's got to know which impala it's got to go to. If it's too big an impala, that impala is going to be fast. It may have the most meat, but there's a chance it won't get it. And if it goes for too small an impala, it can get it, but the meat won't be enough. So it's making a mathematical calculation. But anyway, the cheetah's obviously done this job, and he comes slowly. And he's got to have a flat terrain of land, because his forte is speed, or her forte is speed. And it can accelerate to about 100 miles an hour.
Wow.
100 kilometers an hour. And the impala, from my memory, it's about 50 to 60 kilometers an hour. So there is a difference in speed, and there is a calculated distance, because the cheetah is making a careful calculation. Because if it misses, the cheetah is going to burn out. It's going to collapse on the ground. It's going to overheat, and it'll be about 2-3 hours before it restores energy for the next Ooh. Strike. Yeah. So that's why the cheetah is so vulnerable. It's got these constraints on its environment. So anyway, the cheetah gets within 50 meters, and of course we want the cheetah to get its meal, and slowly the cheetah reaches the range, it's calculated the distance, and begins the run. And the impala gaze at it, and then they explode. The impala's strategy is, first of all, get into numbers, because if you've got large numbers, your odds of you getting killed are lower. And the second strategy is to go in all directions so the cheetah doesn't know where to go. So anyway, this cheetah goes and chases this one impala. It selected the impala. And what's interesting is that these animals are genetically programmed with their relative speeds. So the impala knows that if it keeps going in a straight run at 50 kilometers an hour, the cheetah's going to get it. So its strategy is to veer from side to side. And that's programmed. No one has to coach it. And the cheetah knows it's got to go after it. But the cheetah can't veer or change direction as quickly as the impala because of the higher speed and the heavier weight. So...
Wow.
So the impala veers, the cheetah misses, the impala veers again, and we know that from background that third time it misses, it's gone. And luckily for us, we're cheering for the cheetah. It gets the impala on the third bite.
Wow.
And then the funny thing about the impala is because it's such a slight, about the cheetah, it's such a slight cat. It's got to take the meat of the impala straight away and run away, because the moment it gets it, you get other scavenger predators like the hyena and the jackal who feed on the cheetah kill. And the cheetah cannot withstand the power of those predators either. The jackals, because they're very tricky, and the hyenas, because a single hyena is a threat, let alone many hyena, a pack of hyena. So we saw that happen, and the cheetah and the impala get killed, and then we drove around. But it really illustrates the stresses on the cheetah and the natural environment. And then when you get man encroaching on it with agriculture and the loss of trees and savanna grasses and all that, it's the constraints in terms of a running stretch and the bush on which to hide and all have gone. So you get other cats which are much more versatile, like the leopard, you know, which is a nocturnal animal. The cheetah's only in the day. The leopard's nocturnal, diurnal, and the leopard can survive in a variety of habitats. The cheetah is heavily constrained. So now there's a bottleneck, and we just got some of them in West Africa and in South Africa. At one time, there were thousands in India. Now you don't get a cheetah in India.
So this live experience that you just narrated,
yeah,
sort of gives you a perspective of how to budget, gives you a perspective of how to sort of plan and train the people as such, from a financial perspective, as it is.
Well, the reality is that we got a multiple strategy. First of all, we got to understand the genetics of the cheetah. There's a cheetah bottleneck there because they're interbreeding so heavily. So there's also the scientific side. Remember, there's a bottleneck. So when they're interbreeding, there's a higher risk of recessive genes and all that. So we have to have funds for that area. It's really the funding. And then we've got to have the funds to have various type of initiatives where we engage with the community. Because if we can nurture the children through workshops and all that, and I got involved on that side because it's part of the management. We used to discuss all these issues, which were most cost-effective approaches. Were they meetings, direct one-to-one meetings? Was it good to go through an intermediate village leader who would in turn pass on the message? We had to evaluate our very cost-benefit outcomes. We had to get metrics from the financial system that would measure this, try to measure that success. Yeah, so there was a little bit of performance management. As I said, we can approach it on multiple areas. We can lobby the government too to introduce legislation.
So from there,
yeah.
With wildlife, you moved on to a school. Why the shift?
See, one thing is that you notice there that when you go to Africa, the first thing you notice is the strong Chinese presence. You notice that, or the Asian presence. You see the Indians there too, and the Chinese in terms of infrastructure, physical infrastructure. You see the you see the airports, you see the dams, you see the dams, the roads, I must say the Indian presence also is visible there. You see the Tata trucks, the Mahindra jeeps. You see our three wheelers and two wheelers, which really dominate Africa, which was a nice surprise. But you're talking just here physical infrastructure and industrialization. But everyone, you realize that talking around to all these people in this industry, that the real critical success factor is human capital. If you want to sustain these operations, even like Cheetah, in terms of coaching staff and all that, you got to build up this human capital at a very early age, and that would make it sustainable. And one of the finest ways to provide capital is education, and education at an early age as possible. The other thing is, you notice there's a very high incidence of AIDS there. Yeah, that's 25 to 30%, and it's not only education, it's a multi-pronged initiative, because if you have 25% of your population suffering from AIDS, that's a severe depletion of capital in terms of health cost, in terms of disrupted families. Then you got to think that these 25% people are not in the workforce. Then you got to think of the people who got to stay at home to look after them. So it has heavy costs. So the idea is to introduce education with good health, good nutrition, and there are schools that do that. And then there was this one there. So I was fortunate to meet a lot of people who were in the Red Cross and all, who really did a good job there, and I learned a lot from them. And then I just said, let's do something more substantive.
So you spent how long a time in the school?
I was there for 2 years, a little over 2 years, yes. Yeah, I was there in Uganda, Kampala.
So you used your financial skills, your planning skills, your interpersonal skills, your management skills to sort of build up a good team there to deliver the objectives of education.
That's right. Yeah, I was so I really had interaction right with the CEO and the top management, and but then I had to go to the schools very often. And it wasn't just the teachers, because you were actually building two schools there. So it was actually construction. We were building the physical capacity for it. And we had the primary school, but then there were secondary schools to be built. And, yeah, so I was involved in training many people. I used to go to the schools very often. So while there was no direct interface with the children, I did meet the children there. And you know, the one thing you realize there is that they got such big smiles and they're so natural. And I'm saying, yeah.
So just before we break for a song, a quick question as such. What perception did you have of Uganda before you went there? Because Uganda means everybody talks about Idi Amin. And so what perception did you have before you went there, and what was your experience on the ground?
Yeah, you know, you're right, because the perception is ethnic strife and expropriated assets and genocides and wars, because even here are the Hutu and Tutsi wars. But the thing is, what bleeds, leads. You know what, there's a news thing. What you don't hear about is day-to-day living, which is just wonderful. I mean, it's just the landscapes of Africa, and then the people have a natural warmth. They got such spontaneous smiles. The friendship is there. You know, sometimes you can feel, sometimes it's there in the West too, but sometimes it can get a bit jaded because we meet so many people and, you know, but there, it's a different experience.
So on that note, Cedric, let's listen to the song. You're listening to 104.6 Planet FM, Soshigat Tanpar.
Yeah, 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 y
welcome back. You're listening to Sushega Dhanpar on 104.6 Planet FM. And mujhe sangat aaj asa Cedric DeMello, who's visiting New Zealand. He's settled in Australia. He's visiting New Zealand after his one-year-long trip across the globe. After doing 5 years of voluntary work in Africa, he took a one-year break to travel across the globe. Cedric, you traveled several countries. Why? In this last 1 year.
Right. Yes, I did travel several countries in South America. And then I went more towards Eastern Europe and Asia. The first country I went to after the school was, I went to the Galapagos in near Ecuador. And there my interest was excited by the fact that in Africa I realized how you have such a wide variety of species and how each of them occupies a specific ecological niche in the environment. And I think that was one fascinating part of Africa. You see large predators, you see carnivores, you see herbivores of a great variety. And they occupy niches in different ways, like nocturnal niches, or which are night animals, or diurnal niches, which is day animals. But the thing was that the Galapagos interested me because I heard it's got an environment of various islands and which with a variety of species. And I wanted to see how those species had specifically adapted to those different islands, like the finches or the iguanas, and the tortoises. So it was there that Darwin actually built up his theory of natural selection. So you know, that's what fascinated me, because that's the idea where his fertile mind crystallized the theory. So you go to these different islands around boating, and you see the finches, which he noticed the different designs of the finches. So in a way, that aroused my interest. I wanted to see the Galapagos because it seemed to be a natural outgrowth of my wildlife experience.
But you would have traveled from there to different other countries. Was there a specific purpose of visiting a given country, or is it because the fares were cheap? Or was it a part of a tour that you were?
The main reason was that while I was working, I was constrained by my leave, which was 1 month. And I grew up in India, and I didn't have the financial wherewithal. Like now you look at the Western countries, you get all people who go for year trips and all that, because, you know, the first world gives you that capacity very early to take your break and come back and start a career. And I found that even while I was in Africa, I was taking holidays every 3 months because I was volunteering and they allowed me to go. They were very generous. I took it every 3 months and I visited about 18 countries in Africa. But the thing was, I just wanted this year-long adventure, and I just wanted to let it go by slowly. I didn't want to hurry through it. So like some of them were driven by my specific interest, like animals, like Galapagos. But then I was also very interested in the political situation and the ancient civilizations in South America, like the Maya, the Aztecs, and the Inca, because they were discovered after 1500 by the Europeans, and they had their tremendous advances there, and they were isolated from the rest of the world for just 500 years ago. It's incredible. So I visited a lot of their ancient sites.
Oh, okay.
Their
okay.
temples and their architectural marvels.
So among the several countries that you visited, which one held your fascination apart from South America? Which are the other countries that held your fascination from a human perspective as such?
From a human perspective. Maybe I'm giving more weight to my recent experience, but because I went to about 30 countries in the last year. Yeah, I just traveled a bit in the last year.
A rich man.
No, I'm not rich. I'm just depleting my capital. I've reached a stage where I can deplete my capital, put it this way. I'm depleting financial capital. I'm trying to preserve my human...
Destroying it, is it?
Yeah, sort of. I visited Japan and South Korea, and some people have mixed feelings about those two countries. But you know, the thing that struck me about Japan is that It's a bit like Germany in the sense that there were horrors in the wars, but now they're the most specific, almost in some ways, totally reformed countries.
And close society.
Yeah, Japan is close into... Yeah, there are many contradictions. You know, you say it's got practically isolationist immigration policies, but then how do you reconcile that with the civility and the grace of the people? And... We had breakfast with so many Japanese families, and there's no doubting their sincerity and their warmth. And in case I was deceived, I was traveling with a friend for 5 days and with a group for 10 days. And if anything, I thought it was a very good trip, but they were overwhelmed. Japan's got contradictions, but then lots of countries got contradictions, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Europe has contradictions. India has contradictions. We've got our problems. Yeah.
So how different it is from Korea?
Yeah, you know, Korea to me was so interesting because I stayed there and I went into the DMZ, which is the demilitarized zone on the 30th parallel. And, to me, Korea is a real social laboratory because if you look in 1953, when the end of the war, North Korea had the industrialized, had the heavy industries, and South Korea was a little more impoverished. It had the agriculture and the light industries. But then North Korea wedded to communism and South Korea wedded to capitalism and the free market order and the American institutional systems. And today, the very same country, the very same ethnic group, you have the South Koreans, 12 times the GDP. South Koreans are taller than the North Koreans, but I think about, if I got it right, a couple of inches. And they're producing products like Samsung and Hyundai and Daewoo. And, the small country of South Korea has got its products all over the globe, and North Korea is enmeshed in nothing. And the fact is that the South Koreans are heavily educated. So again, that shows that there's a, coming back to that school thing, there's an educational premium. The education can do it, exposure to institutions. Mm-hmm. Just fascinating.
On that note, just let's take a break and listen to a song.
Mira, mira. Mira, mira. Mira, mira. Mira, mira. Sanglele mapsha sukrara ata wora zaun geli dobara koi paole moje mira aliste faro ta koi tasa lagto chagorya chagasa au pur pur jagelo lo dasa tu faro lo moga chafasa mira 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 bel tamur sang lele mapsha sukrara ata ora zaun gelingo bara koi paole moje mira lele ye kitte kushig te bos lele tat garam ma ka has lele karna kaadis ye moga ta chala has lele mira 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 Sanglele mapsha sukrara ata wora zaun geli gomara koi paole moje mira zop pe tăile, nață, dacă avea utoile, caleza chia moja fotoile, ani moga ce gărdui tutoile. Mira, 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 mira. Sanglele mapșa sucrara, ata ora za un gelingobara, coi paole, moje mira. I love you, moje mira. I will wait for you.
तुम्ही ऐकत आहात सुशिका दनपार 104.6 प्लॅनेट एफ एम अवॉइट. मुझे सांगत आज असा मुझो फ्रेंड आणि प्रोफेशनल कलीग सेड्रिक डिमेलो. ही लिव्स इन ऑस्ट्रेलिया, हॅज ट्रॅव्हल फॉर ऑलमोस्ट अ इयर आफ्टर डुईंग वॉलंटरी वर्क इन आफ्रिका फॉर द लास्ट 5 इयर्स. सेड्रिक, वेन वी ब्रोक ऑफ यू टॉक्ड अबाउट दिस कंपॅरिझन बिटवीन जपान अँड साऊथ कोरिया. And then you talked about the comparison between North Korea and South Korea and how important it is to develop human capital. You have worked in your voluntary area to conserve the wildlife cheetah, as well as you have worked to build human capital by constructing schools in Africa as such. Is there any some sort of a correlationship in this passion and this choice of voluntary work as such between human capital and the animal kingdom?
Yes, I think there is correlation, because man has a strong stake in both, you know. If you go to the animal kingdom, for example, you see there's a strong dissonance in the view of the tourist and the view of the farmer. The farmer sees the cheetah as a predator, which is attacking its livelihood and its his fundamentally his financial assets. To him, it's a threat because he's in poverty. But then you get the tourists and the rest of the world who view the killing of a cheetah as a gross act. But the thing is, to the many farmers, we look at it, we come across as elite tourists. So how do you resolve that dissonance in the views? To an impoverished farmer seeing a wild animals destroy it. But the reality is that many of them are pushed to agriculture and that expansion because of increasing poverty. So if we want to have a stake in that and we want to preserve the wildlife, we realize you've got to invest in it. And you can invest in it either through financial means, or countries can donate, or if they want to preserve it. Or secondly, we can go there and create the human capital, because once you set up the educational system, and as I said, once you can increase the health environment, the high incidence of AIDS, 25%, etc., once you can intervene, those interventions will bring remarkable returns in both places. You look at Uganda, for example. Uganda has a median age of 15. So it's the second youngest country from memory on the planet. But then it's got 35% unemployment in the youth. The only way you're going to snap them out of this type of intergenerational poverty cycle is by investing very early in their education and their health, their nutrition, because it's very easy to see, people lazing around here or there or saying, it's just a lack of discipline. But the fact is that all of them have their roots very early in early pre-primary school education, in bad nutrition, in very unpleasant home environments. And once you break that circle, you'll see returns very high. There'll be enormous social returns.
So, Cedric, we're just coming close to our program, close to the time to finish our program. A quick message to our listeners. If you want to pursue a passion in voluntary work, what is it that is required?
We've got different stages in our life, but I think eventually you may ultimately feel like returning back something. And you may also be a bit jaded with your daily urban routines, and you may say, why not go to Africa, but don't let the inhibiting factor be the ethnic strife and the dictatorships and the endless wars which you think go in certain parts, because the reality is quite different. You'll find Africa very refreshing. It's got a wonderful landscape. The Africans on a day-to-day basis are very accepting. I had no issues at all, I can say that. I would have told you if I saw high risks there. There is, of course, the risks that come with poverty and violence, but mind you, nothing happened to me. and I went around feeling very comfortably. Yeah. So follow your passion, and I'm telling you, you'll get good returns, and you'll find it will rejuvenate you, I think. You'll have a fresh look at life.
So thanks Cedric, yeah, for coming and joining us on our program, sharing your experiences, your life experiences in Africa, your choices that you have made to pursue your passion. I wish you all the best when you return back to Australia and carry on with the other works that you plan to do there over the next few years. On that note, I say adios to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in and have a nice, good evening.
Piti kali zezata Nidlea nidu polo na puntu zo zugras makayeta Godvingin maka todota Chitun mutun moje kisto geta Piti mogyam so kali zata.